The time is 11 o'clock. Coming up next on Stage and Studio, host Dee Mae Roberts talks with author Jamie Ford about his newest book, Songs of Willow Frost. Set in Depression-era Seattle, it's the story of a 12-year-old Chinese-American boy. And at 11:30 on Art Focus, host Ava Lake speaks with Darren Orange, a painter from Astoria who is well known for his emotional and expressive work based in Oregon landscape. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from the Clinton Street Theater, featuring independent and revival films, the Rocky Horror Picture Show every Saturday at midnight, as well as the monthly KBOO Movie Night. The Clinton Street Theater is located at the corner of Southeast Clinton and 26th in Portland. Schedule and information at 503-238-5588 or cstpdx.com.
I'm Dee Mae Roberts, Stage and Studio. We're listening to music by the Orchid Ensemble. You can find their music at orchidensemble.com. Jamie Ford, author of the acclaimed debut novel Hotel on the Corner of Bitter and Sweet, has written another epic historical novel. This is the second time Ford has made it onto the New York Times bestseller list. In Hotel, Ford created a love story about a Chinese-American boy and a Japanese-American girl who lived in Seattle. They are separated when the girl and her family are incarcerated in an internment camp during World War II. Ford's newest novel, Songs of Willow Frost, tells another powerful tale of heartbreak. It's set in Depression-era Seattle, and it's the story of an Asian-American orphan boy searching for the mother who abandoned him 5 years before. The first part of the book follows William's quest to meet Willow Frost, a film star performing in Seattle. When William sees her in a film, he instantly recognizes the star as his mother. William then runs away from the orphanage through the worst parts of Seattle to get to the theater where he hopes Willow Frost is performing. Ford writes with painstaking historic detail of Seattle's Skid Row in the Depression. Jamie Ford came to my studio to talk about Songs of Willow Frost. He grew up in the Seattle area, but now lives in Montana with his family. I asked him about his personal connection to Seattle, the setting for both of his books.
For me, the most significant personal element is the Wami Club. That's where my grandparents met. My grandfather was a blackjack dealer, and my grandmother was a coat check girl. The Wami Club has a unfortunate appearance in Washington history books as a location of a mass murder in the 80s when the place was robbed and they shot a bunch of people. But before that, it was this place in the community going all the way back to Prohibition times when people wanted, you know, before Vegas, if you wanted, you know, booze and gambling and dancing and music and all kinds of illicit good times, you went to Chinatown. You went to places like the Wami.
What does Wami stand for? I mean, what happened there?
Well, in the 80s, three gunmen went in to rob the place about 2 in the morning and ended up shooting everyone. They killed 13 people. And it was really sad beyond the epic tragedy of that, but it really, I always say they came in and murdered the entire neighborhood, because it really blighted the neighborhood. It painted the neighborhood got painted in the press as this den of inequity, and it really crippled the neighborhood economically for really a couple decades. It wasn't until really 20 years later with the Wajimaya and the Wing Luke and these other places that popped up and anchored the community. And it drove me nuts, because Seattle is a town of great affluence. There's Microsoft and Amazon. There's all this money poured on the city, and yet Chinatown remained as this forgotten little community.
How far back do your roots go to Seattle?
Well, my dad was born there, and my grandfather came through Canada to. He worked in Vancouver, British Columbia, but later worked in Seattle. That's where most of my Chinese family is, there and places in Nevada, some in California. My parents moved back to the Seattle area. We lived in Port Orchard, but I later lived in Seattle. My dad grew up on Beacon Hill. That's where my grandparents were. He went to the Chonghua building, Chonghua Center, to learn city Cantonese to get rid of his country dialect. So we have roots going back pretty far. I mean, originally my great-grandfather came to this country through San Francisco and ended up settling in Tonopah, Nevada, working for the Borax Mining Company. But it's where he spent his childhood. It's where I spent a great deal of my formative years. And so that's always, when I think of home, it's Seattle.
What is your, I guess, your personal connection to the history itself? Because it seems like you're going back in time. You were in World War II, right, with Japanese-American internment and in hotel on the corner of Bitter and Sweet. And now you're in Depression-era Seattle from an Asian perspective, which I, to my knowledge, and maybe you know this, I don't think that's ever been done in a novel. Do you know, especially from an Asian American perspective?
I've never really thought about it. You might be onto something. You know, I think I was born in the wrong century, because I am going back. My third book goes back even earlier to 1909. So I'm eventually, you know, I'm going to have to get back to a boat heading back to China in reverse or something like that. No, it's an interesting time. I do that because I said, I don't know where I wrote it down one time, someone had asked, and I said, I really feel my writing career began when I wrote my parents' obituaries. Once those doors were closed to me, I just thought of all the questions I had never asked, and I regret not asking them. And so it makes me want to explore the world, the Seattle that existed in my dad's childhood, in my grandfather's childhood, to explore those, to feel a connection to them. You know, I miss them. I lament their passing. And it gives me this catharsis when I write about these things.
When you're looking back, you're actually looking at your present at the same time, totally. In comparison?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. People ask. It's interesting because you think writing a book that maybe has a little bit of personal history is this confessional experience. And in a way it is. But then people see through that and they ask questions that you never thought of to ask yourself. And someone asked me recently, you know, why Seattle? Why do I keep writing about Seattle? And I had to think about it beyond just growing up there and my dad growing up there. But the more I thought about it, Seattle was where I first had my heart broken. So I'm emotionally wedded to that city, and I like writing about those things, so it works for me.
Well, heartbreak is a theme both in your first book, Hotel on the Corner of Bitter and Sweet, and Songs of Willow Frost. I mean, they both are about heartbreak.
They are, you know, and I like complicated people's stories. I like stories about the human condition, and those things are interesting to me. In nonfiction, you just kind of see what actually happens. With fiction, you can attempt to make sense of it. You can explore it in a way you can't do strictly going by the historical record. So you can write stories of tragedy and redemption instead of just stories of tragedy.
I'm fascinated by the orphanage. It's set in an orphanage with this young boy. He's 12 years old. His name is William Eng. Mm-hmm. And that's the main character for a while.
It is.
For a while. And you describe the orphanage that he lives in. And I assume that's a historic orphanage.
Yeah, the Sacred Heart Orphanage was a real place. The building's still there. It's called the Villa Academy now. So it's this very nice Tony private school. But back in the day, it was an orphanage that during the Depression, a lot of parents couldn't care for their children, so they just consigned their kids to places like Sacred Heart. And for me, it's, if you were an orphan and you'd lost your parents, there's an aspect of tragedy and sadness. But if your parents put you there and you never knew if or when they were coming back, that's even more distressing. It's amazing. I did an event about a week ago, and a woman came up to me. She waited in line to the very end, and she came up to me and said, "Hi, my name's Margaret. I grew up at the Sacred Orphanage in Seattle." She drove 127 miles to be there to share the story of being the daughter of a single mother. She had a brother and a sister. They were caught in the teeth of the Depression in the 30s, and her mom turned them into the orphanage, came back one time a year later to bring them winter coats, and she never saw her mother again, never knew what happened to her. So, I mean, just there's people like the truth in fiction. And I, as a researcher, I love finding these things and hearing Margaret's story. Her real story was even more, it was more heartbreaking than the fiction that I had put on paper.
Have you stayed in touch with her? I mean, this was she your inspiration for this book?
No, I had never met her. She came down from the Browning Indian Reservation, and I got her name, I got her number, and I actually go through Browning whenever I go up to Glacier to go hiking. I went up there 5 times this summer, so I told her I'd pop in next time I'm through town.
She came to your reading and just told you, this book is my life, essentially.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, some people read, and I do the same thing. I read a certain type of book, and I connect with the book, I identify with it, and I just want to meet the author sometimes and say, you know, you made my week, you made my day. It was a moment where I felt like someone understands me.
Why do you think that is? Because we all share that, and I think that's why these big events, like Wordstock or any kind of writer's event. What is it about wanting to meet the writer?
sometimes you're a writer and people come to events and they want to pick your brain about the writing process. And that's one thing. Other times, they just want to know if they really like the story, they want to know what is it about this person. They want to know some of the inside details to gain a deeper understanding of perhaps what's on the page. Sometimes I meet an author, I just want to know, how'd you do it? You know, how did you see the parade that's going on inside my head and report back so well? I mean, you just want to commune with the writer over these little details.
Well, who are your favorite writers?
So my favorite writers, contemporary writers, I love Sherman Alexie. I'm a big Pat Conroy fan. I love his writing. I just love him as a gentleman. I'm a huge Harlan Ellison fan. And that shocks people sometimes, but Harlan was one of these writers that he haunted my imagination as a kid, and he kept haunting it as an adult. I've been fortunate enough to get to know Harlan, and he would kill me if he heard me say this, but he's a really nice guy. He's such a sweetheart, and he has this larger than life, very abrasive, vengeful persona, which I think is part true, part shtick. But the reality is he's a fine human being.
He's actually the only writer who's ever called me personally to tell me he couldn't do an interview with me and explained why. So I totally believe that.
He's a generous guy. I mean, he's actually very gracious with his time. And when I first met him, I was doing this thing up in Seattle with the Seattle 7 writers where we were writing a novel, taking shifts and writing it over about 4 days. And we were doing it in front of a live audience. And I knew Harlan had traveled around the world and had written as performance. And so I wrote to him asking him if I could have a little token of his, like maybe one of his pipes or something I'd bring up on stage as an homage. And he called me up. We talked for about 90 minutes on the phone. He told me all kinds of cool stories and the history of why he ended up doing that. And then he sent me a pipe. He sent me a T-shirt. He sent me all kinds of little tchotchkes, and it was a great first meeting.
Well, it's good to hear a writer who's on the New York Times bestseller list talking about other writers because we all get inspired.
Oh, totally. No, and Harlan's nonfiction, his essays that he would write for all these different newspapers in the 70s and 80s and television commentary, those are my friends. I mean, I can crack those books open and just read an essay any time of the day.
Well, speaking of essays or short pieces, both of your books actually started off as short pieces, as short stories.
Yeah, Hotel was a short story, and Songs of Willow Frost was... It really, I'd been doing the research. I had the character of Willow in my mind. And then I was invited to an event in Washington it was Humanities Washington, where they invite 5 authors to read at this gala fundraiser. It's 400 people. They're wearing black tie. And they have us come in and read something special that we've written just for the event. And so I had these 12 hastily typed pages of the character of William. He was an orphan. And as I was writing it, it was one of those moments, especially as I was reading it and hearing the story out loud in front of an audience, that I realized that I had these imaginary friends. One was William and one was Willow. And I really felt like they were both tapping me on the shoulder saying, we know each other, right? You know, our stories are connected. And that was really the impetus to turn it into a novel.
Well, having just read Songs of Willow Frost, I was wondering which part of the book did you write, or is it still in the book?
No, it's almost intact. With the short story that I wrote that became Hotel, that got divided, it got parsed out into about three or four chapters. But I had Willow in mind. I had the character of, you know, a tragic character in her youth who would become a silent film star, but had a haunted past. And then I was writing this other story of William, of this boy who's waiting for his mother to return one day. And the pages that I wrote, almost in their entirety, translated directly to the opening of the novel.
So it was in the opening of the novel. You just basically wrote the opening of the novel as a short story.
Yeah, you know, I was just going to write it as a short story, button it up. But as I got towards the end, I had them going to the Moore Theater, and that's when I realized he would see this other character that I had imagined, and that they would actually be related.
You're listening to Stage and Studio. I'm Demi Roberts, talking with author Jamie Ford about his second hit novel, Songs of Willow Frost. To find out more about Jamie Ford, visit jamieford.com or stageandstudio.org, where I have a review of Ford's book. Right now we're listening to music by the Orchid Ensemble. You can find their music at orchidensemble.com. There is a big turning point in the Songs of Willow Frost. Ford shifts perspective from the 12-year-old William Eng to the earlier life of Willow Frost. The rest of the book tells the story of a young girl who dreamt of becoming a singer, who was forced by circumstance to give up her child.
Without giving too much away, there's a part in the book that I felt like was the story or the reveal that could have been done if it was a short story within a couple of paragraphs of what happened to the boy and how he ended up in the orphanage. But instead, that's the last two-thirds of the book,
right,
you know?
Right.
And I thought that was fascinating to me. I mean, just from in the writing process itself, in that there's a section that if you wanted to have somebody explain, i.e. the mother, why she left the young boy at the orphanage, that could have happened in a couple of pages,
sure,
right, as a story that
yeah.
she told. But instead, it really is the bulk of the book, and it's beautifully done.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, if it was just summed up in a couple moments without a deeper understanding, it would have to end in just pure tragedy. And I didn't want it to be so epically sad, because the depression and the orphanage, I mean, we're already jumping off from a point of sadness. And I wanted to steer the boat to a point where hopefully there would be some redemptive moments, where some solace, some places where the characters can have some resolution to things that they've been hoping for and pining away for. It also gave me an opportunity to explore all these things that happened to Lu Song, who becomes Willow, from her in her past growing up in Chinatown to jumping up onto the silver screen, and all the things she had to sacrifice to get there.
It can be seen as depressing, you know, because it is in the Depression era. And yet there's hope that runs through the entire book. And perhaps it's a young person's hope, but it's also the hope of Liu Song, who is hoping for a better life for herself. And it's the immigrant dream hope, too. And I also think that it's interesting that most people would view the Depression era stories as depressing enough, but if you throw in their racism and discriminatory laws that people of color had to go through, and especially Asian Americans, because the laws were definitely in the books up until World War II, and that especially for Chinese, that they couldn't really legally immigrate here.
Yeah, there was the reality was tragic. I mean, I didn't have to dress it up to make it that way. I just had to reveal it as it was.
You've got Liu Song, who ends up actually doing well for herself, seemingly.
Sure.
And a lot of that basis, I mean, I can't help but, you know, compare her to Anna Mae Wong in her story, because her story as the, you know, the Hollywood legend of her time, and probably the most successful Asian American actress, not just in that period, but up until probably the civil rights era. Was Anna Mae Wong an inspiration to you?
Yeah, the character of Willow Frost is an amalgam. There's a little bit of my mom, a little bit of my Chinese grandmother, and definitely a nod to Anna Mae Wong, because she's this character that is the perfect definition of success doesn't equal happiness. She was too American for a Chinese suitor, and she dated all of these Caucasian directors and producers in Hollywood, but at the time they could never get married because of the legalities involved. She was famous, she was on the silver screen, but she could never have an on-screen kiss until she moved to Europe. She was relegated to the role of a villainess until she left the country. And even in her later years, she could never marry. She traveled to China. She was born an American. She traveled to China thinking she would be received as this, you know, starlet. And they really didn't like her. And so she, in many ways, she died of a broken heart, I think. There's something about that that is just emblematic of what a person of a certain ethnicity was able to achieve during that time period. There was a limit to the success that they could enjoy. And then it was marred by the fact that their own culture kind of turned on them, saw them as a pariah for selling out. Over time, we can look back and qualify everything and see her as a breakthrough artist and as a really great actress. But at the time, in her own lifetime, it wasn't always, you know, it wasn't always a success and happy story.
I'm thinking, and you probably have come across this, that both of your books, you know, have young people, mm-hmm. and they could even be included in curriculums across the country in high schools, I would think, at least.
Yeah, Hotel definitely gets read in schools a lot. I get, I laugh nervously because at the tail end of summer, because kids get assigned a summer reading list, but they promptly throw it away and they don't look at it until the first week before school begins. And I get this deluge of emails from high school students, you know, like, I love your book, Motel on the Corner of Sweet and Sour. Can you, you know, what's the theme? And I do respond, but sometimes I just want to say, you know, the theme is turn off the Xbox and read a book, you know, just, I get all these emails and it's.
They're actually asking you to cheat for them.
Yeah. My favorite part is on Twitter, because I'm on Twitter, and so all these high school kids are on Twitter, and so there's the positives, the blunt positives of, wow, this is the best book, you know, this is the first book I was ever forced to read that didn't actually suck, you know, those kind of things. Or I get the ones where it's like, this book is, you know, I want to kill myself, kill me now, this book is awful. And I always retweet all the bad ones, you know.
You know, I hadn't thought about that. I hadn't thought about this digital age that we're living in, and how accessible, especially you are, not all authors, but you are pretty accessible. And you take it in great stride, but at times it seems like it could be a deluge to your writing process. I mean, just sort of a distraction.
Sure. Oh, yeah. I mean, there's no greater distraction than the teenagers in my own house, honestly. So,
In the meantime, they don't really care.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. I can't unfriend them. I can't unfollow them.
They don't really care that you're famous and that other teens are you know, asking you, I mean, you know, for whatever.
The only care that I'm a writer when they're mortified by one of their Facebook friends, you know, posting, I'm reading your dad's book, you know, then they're shocked. But
have they read your books?
Yeah. One willingly, and a couple were assigned to it and they had to read it for school. So, yeah, it's a mixed bag. The one that read it willingly really liked it. So, I mean, she's just now jumping into Songs of Willow Frost.
So you don't, like, as a parent, say, okay, children, because they're old enough, I want you to read my latest chapter, right, and read it around the dinner table or something?
No, I'd get nothing done. They would just slice and dice me to ribbons. It would be awful.
Oh, they'd be critical.
Oh, they'd be terrible. Yeah, they'd be, this is the most boring book ever, you know. Where are the zombies? Where are the glittery vampires? So...
Well, maybe that's your next book,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, exactly.
Set at the turn of the century.
Yeah.
So we're going back in time. Final question about your next book. You're going back to the turn of the century this time. Yeah. We've been through World War II. We've been through Depression era. Now you're going to the turn of the century. What's happening there?
What's happening there? 1909, the AYP, the Alaska-Yukon Pacific Exposition, the first World's Fair in Seattle, before the Space Needle World's Fair, the World's Fair in 62. And they had there was 100 days of the fair. They had themed days. And every day they gave away something. They raffled off something based on its theme. And so one day was an agricultural day, and they raffled off a bushel of wheat. And another day they might have raffled off a cow. And on one particular day, they raffled off a child. And it was a boy who was donated by... Yeah, I love that look on your face as I say that. That was donated by the Washington Receiving's Home. And no one knows what happened to this kid. And so he's one of the characters in the story. And, I mean, there's a lot of other really interesting and salacious things.
It was an Asian boy? Or
nobody knows.
Oh.
Nobody knows who...
So who is it going to be in your book?
You'll have to wait and see. Yeah, I actually, you know, I've written his backstory and the circumstances of him being there and other characters. And it'll be another complicated family story spanning. It's bookended between the World's Fair. So it goes from 1909 to about 1959. Another complicated family story. There will definitely be some love story elements to it and some heartbreaking moments.
So you're going back in time, and it's almost like August Wilson's Chronicles and backwards, you know?
Yeah. You know, I do like just digging a little bit deeper, and it seemed to make sense. There were these windows of history that were worth stepping through and you know, kind of putting my feet on the dirt and walking around.
Well, I wish you luck on that one, too, and continued success. It's been so great talking with you, Jamie Ford. Thanks for joining us on Stage and Studio.
Woohoo! Thanks for having me.
Author Jamie Ford of the New York Times bestseller, Songs of Willow Frost. To find out more about him, visit stageandstudio.org or jamieford.com. We've been listening to music by the Orchid Ensemble. Learn more about them at orchidensemble.com. That's it for Stage and Studio. I'm Dee Mae Roberts. If you missed any of this show, visit stageandstudio.org. You can also download shows at iTunes. And don't forget to like us on facebook.com/stage_n_studio. And post a comment on why you listen to this show on the Facebook page. You can also tweet me a comment or event update at stage_n_studio or write me at stage_n_studio@aol.com. Till next time, I'm Dee Mae Roberts.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to help co-sponsor the Triangle production of American Fiesta, starring Gary Wayne Cash, a witty, hopeful tale of imperfection and acceptance. American Fiesta will take place at the Sanctuary at Sandy Plaza, 1785 Northeast Sandy Boulevard in Portland. This Triangle production will run from November 29th through December 22nd. More information about this KBOO-sponsored event may be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. The time is just coming on 11:30. Coming up next on Art Focus, host Ava Lake speaks with Darren Orange, a painter from Astoria who is well known for his emotional and expressive work based in Oregon landscape. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Oregon College of Art and Crafts Studio School, offering classes and workshops for adults in book arts, ceramics, drawing and painting, fibers, metals, photography, and wood. www.ocac.edu/register.
Andy Warhol, let's just scream, hang him on my wall.
Good morning. Thanks so much for listening to Art Focus. My name is Ava Lake, and I have with me today Darren Orange. He's a painter who lives in Astoria, and I am the one who wrote that his work is based in an expressive and emotional sort of investment in Oregon landscape. But I think that's actually not completely true. I've done a little bit more of my homework and investigation on his work. And I know that, Darren, you paint a lot of different things, and we're going to talk about them today. Thanks so much for joining me today.
Thank you.
Yes. So for those of you out there, if you're not familiar with Darren's work, you can go to darrenorange.com, and his website's got a lot of images that we're going to be talking about today. Also, just kind of a brief disclosure. About 10 years ago, I had a gallery called Love Lake, a tiny little space with green walls in Northwest Portland, and I showed Darren Orange. So I just wanted to let you know all of that. And I even brought my old press release with me and postcard, just kind of going back in memory lane. I think what we ought to do, first of all, is just sort of briefly describe your work, Darren. This is radio, so, you know, we have to do a little bit of description here. I know I've got my own words for it, but I want you to go first. Someone's asking you what you make. What would you tell them?
That's the hard part, right?
Yes.
I mean... gritty, layered.
Uh-huh.
It's a result of process.
Uh-huh.
So there's a visual history.
Yeah.